This is the Car Dealer Podcast driven by CarGurus. You want the best return for your advertising budgets, and CarGurus Piston Heads are focused on the same goal. With them, you have access to millions of monthly shoppers across both sites. Connect with in-market high-quality buyers today and turbocharge your digital forecourt. For more information, visit dealerpackages.cargurus.co.uk and schedule a demo with their team. That's dealerpackages.cargurus.co.uk and tell them we sent you.
Welcome back to the Car Dealer Podcast. If you haven't listened before, we pick our favourite stories of the week and ask an industry guest to choose which were the best. I'm John Ray, and joining me this week is founder of Car Dealer Magazine and part-time scam interceptor, Mr. James Baggett.
Thank you, John. I like that. Sound like Matt Allwright there. Nice. That was quite a nice intro for once. Thank you.
Oh, well, I ran out of scathing things to say. Normal service will be resumed next week. How's your week been?
It's been very good. Thanks, John. It's been very good. It's been new car week for me this week, which has been incredibly exciting. Our guests will be disgusted at it, but we'll get to that in a moment. I've just swapped the Audi RS4 long term that I was running for an Audi RS6, and it is absolutely amazing. 600 brake horsepower, incredibly loud, and just perfect size now to get the baby seat in the back. So very, very happy about that.
Very practical vehicle then.
Great. And the other thing you'll be very pleased to hear, because I know you like to hear my building work updates. And yesterday, the builders wrote me in again to help them with the work outside, because they knocked off at 3 p.m. Whether that was because I was helping them, I don't know. But I popped down there and towards the end of the day, I said, is there anything I can do to help? And they said, yeah, see that massive pile of rubble over there? Can you sort the rubble out from the bricks and make a pile of bricks? Which I did. It was very hard work, but I just started to think that now they're trying to con me into these really weird sort of tasks, which aren't actually tasks.
I was hoping you were going to say, do you see that pile of rubble over there? Can you turn that into an extension? She's not far off what you've done.
That is actually their job. So yeah, in between that, writing lots of stories. It's obviously been a short week, but it's been a monster week for traffic. We had an absolutely mad weekend, thanks to one story, which I'm sure we'll come on to. But apart from that, all good with me. How are you, John?
I'm very well. I mean, my last week was new car week, but James Batchelor didn't discuss it with me, so I'm going to discuss it with you.
What was it then?
Well, my Mazda CX-5 has turned into, like a pumpkin into a coach, into a CX-60 3.3-litre diesel, straight six, which is very nice.
A new diesel.
A new diesel, a brand new, enormous diesel.
And how is it?
It's very nice, actually. Yeah, it sounds very big and diesel-y. It's got
is it like a CX-5, but only bigger?
No. Well, yes. No, it's a whole new architecture, James. It's a completely different platform.
Of course it is. You've read the press pack, haven't you?
I have, yes. Yeah. No, it's very exciting, and it's also getting 40-something miles per gallon everywhere, even though it's 300-bit litres.
We should probably, John, introduce our guest at this point,
yes,
who's going to be disgusted at the fact that you're driving a diesel and I'm driving a 600 brake horsepower V8.
That's right. Well, yeah. Our guest this week, yes, certainly knows his things about electric vehicles, which is a topic we hardly ever cover, actually, on the podcast. I don't think we've ever spoken about them, or Kazoo. It's co-founder of electric car dealer EV Experts, Martin Miller. Hello, Martin.
Hello. Thanks for having me on the show. No, all good.
Any comments about our
choice of vehicles?
I think the word no comment is probably best.
Very diplomatic, Martin. Very diplomatic. Now, Martin, I'd love to hear a little bit about your business, because electric vehicles has obviously been a massive topic for us at Car Dealer. Just firstly, your dealership is the one on the A3, is that right?
I knew you'd say that, James.
Is that the one that we're thinking about?
Yeah. So yes. we've got two sites, one on the A3, literally the bit by Guildford. Once you've been stuck in Guildford and you're finally out the way and you're heading south, you hoof it up, get your particulates out the back and dump them all on top of my electric cars as you go up the hill. Now that's for John, obviously. And then we have another one over in Hampshire, just north of the M3 as well, in Hookham.
So I've always been fascinated by that dealership in Guildford, because is it next to the Gulfstream place, or what it was
it used to be a compound for Inchcape Jaguar Land Rover in Guildford. They stopped using it as compound, and I drove past it as I'd started up EV Experts, and it was literally just a compound. It had no facilities, it had no electricity, no water. And like everything in when you're starting up a business, you want it on the cheap, and it is quite cheap. But we've now managed to make it into something a bit more, and so that's why we're there. We love the irony, because the actual building was the old BP petrol station, and American Golf used to be a little chef. So, happy days.
I suppose it's probably got huge advantages and disadvantages. And the advantages in the fact that you must have a huge amount of passing traffic. I mean, in terms of advertising, that must be gold dust, really.
Yeah. I mean, literally the two cabins that we put there, we branded up, bit of vinyl on the outside. Yeah, my background's advertising, and yeah, it is an absolute, it's great. The other advantage of it is it's such a horrible junction to pull out of, that you demonstrate the instant acceleration of an EV, whatever time of day you're pulling out in front of that HGV. So yes, you do have to, sitting in the passenger seat with a customer is sometimes a bit foolhardy. We don't take them out of that junction, because it is brutal.
So tell me a little bit about how you started in this business, and why you picked EVs.
I've always worked in advertising, and worked for various advertising agencies. And I also worked for Nokia. So I knew a bit about cars, a bit about batteries. I took some time off back in 2015, 2016. My sister got a cancer, so I had to move back to the Isle of Wight, look after her for a bit. And at that point, I was about to return to Microsoft, I got told at the age of 47 that, marketing director at the age of 47, I'm a bit old for that. Not that I'm bitter or twisted, that it was a 31-year-old that told me. So at that point, as they say, thought of new opportunities, and so I did. I wanted to buy an electric car. Various dealer groups didn't do themselves much favour back in 2016 when I tried to purchase an EV. No names, no pack drill. But it was, that's what spurred me into thinking, somebody's going to sell EVs, pre-owned EVs. Somebody's going to do it, and somebody's going to do it properly. And that was 6 years ago.
It must have been an absolute roller coaster of a ride then in the last 6 years. I mean, you were probably one of the first out there when it came to specializing in used EVs. So I suppose there was probably a really, really good boom time. And then you've had this really awkward period over the last 6 to 8 months that must have been a bit painful.
Yeah, painful is the absolute test. I mean, it was horrible. It is interesting also because the demographic has changed. When we started in 2017, I mean, I think the first thing I sold was a 24 kilowatt Leaf that does 65, 70 on a good day. You know, those were real innovators, real early adopters. They'd also travel long, long distances to buy the car, because I really wish I'd taken a photo of the, a screenshot of the original Auto Trader when we first launched. I think there was less than 1,000 EVs for sale, full stop, on Auto Trader. And of course, there are a bit more now. And so we were getting people who were traveling distances. They were really knowledgeable by the time they turned up. They were complete geeks, and I can use that word because I'm a geek myself. That's the audience we were. But now we're in a early majority situation. So it's a very, very different market. We still serve our geek community, but there is a lot more people who are just making the decision for rational reasons as well.
And we were talking very briefly just before we came on to this podcast about these drops in used EV prices. I mean, how's that been for you, and how have you been able to manage that situation?
Well, it's been incredibly tough. I mean, yeah, we have, it's not been a comfortable financially situation to be in, of course, but the situation is that you ultimately it's brilliant news, because ultimately we are pretty much at price parity on a lot of models now. And if I'm sitting, I'm with the customer and 120 quid to fill up their RS6, I think. And, even if you've got off-street parking, you can fill up that Porsche Taycan for around £30. Now, those prices are here, and that makes a very sensible decision. You can talk to people on an economic level that's really good. But yeah, it's been a really tough, as we were saying just before we started, we sold more cars in August than we did between September and December. But there is stability back in, and I think the market's evolving.
Interesting that you say that it was a sort of a good thing, and in some ways I do agree with you, because electric cars were very expensive, weren't they? They were seen as expensive options. So there did need to be that sort of price realignment. It just they did need to drop to this sort of level. And actually now people can make rational choices of actually, what do I want? They don't have to think, well, actually, I want to be greener. I want to be more environmentally friendly, but it's going to cost me more to do it. So I think it has been a good thing. But I do really feel for all the dealers out there that had those cars in stock at the time, those electric cars, as they started literally plummeting by the day in price. Did you have to massively readjust prices, and did you kind of get rid of all of the stuff that you had in and then rebought it cheaper? I mean, how have you actually managed that process?
We've stayed competitive on market prices. We haven't done a complete fire sale of throwing everything away. Some of the losses are frighteningly big. But some of the profits on some of the units we've sold recently and bought and sold recently have been also quite nice. We haven't made up for all the losses. But, we're picking stuff up in auction now that is, well, I think any market that's falling, somebody's got a call, I'm going to get back in that market and I'll get at the bottom.
Yeah.
And right now, when the equivalent petrol or diesel car is parity or even more expensive, if you're looking at something like the Minis, you just think, well, that seems like a good time to go back in. We've never had more cars in stock, and that's because we're buying strong right now, because I see this as it is what it is. It's an opportunity. It's a market. You can't wish for it to change. You've got to just make the best decisions that you can.
We've been chatting to Cap HPI's Darren Martin a lot about electric vehicle prices, and we have a monthly update from him. And it's always been at the forefront of our conversations. He said it's some models, it's starting to level out now, these price drops. There are some that still need to drop, but the Tesla price impact after they dropped their new car prices in January had a big impact. Are you seeing it starting to level out now? You're obviously seeing, you're right at the coalface of this.
Yeah, I mean, the weekend before, we were at Fully Charged Live, and we had 21 vehicles on stand, and there were 30,000 people walked through, and most of them wanted to sit in the BMW i4. It was really interesting. But yeah, we had a Jaguar I-Pace on at £33,500. It was a 2018, less 20,000 miles, right colour, right spec, right van roof. People could not believe that was £33,500. It was just, wow, I can get that car for that money. we've got things like the Peugeot E208s, at around £20,000 for something that does real world about 160, 170 miles, 100 kilowatt fast charging, nice platform, still going to be a manufacturer's warranty.
Good looking car.
And it's a good looking car.
Yeah.
So you've got all, again, it's about absolutely Darren's right. You've got to, there are markets that there are cars that are got further to go, but there are also cars that are going to go north and genuinely go north quite a lot because, you know, the clearly, if you can buy a Jaguar I-Pace for 33, which you used to pay for a Nissan Leaf E Plus.
Yeah. What are you buying at the moment then? What's hot for you?
We're finding the anything on the Stellantis platform, the Corsa, the E208, 2008 is a core platform. We are still selling lots of Nissan Leaf because a sub 20K for a big battery Nissan Leaf is a lot of car for the money. And you can genuinely look people in the eyes and say it's a really reliable product. It's a great all-rounder. Yeah, it's not going to excite the petrol head in me. But guess what? Not all your customers are driven by that. And so it's got a good story.
Do you think there's a chance these things will bounce back in a big way? Because if we look back to July last year, things like Nissan Leafs were... That wasn't really the natural price point for them to be at, you know, 24 kilowatt Leafs. They were insanely expensive. I say that as part of a household that bought a 24 kilowatt Leaf at the high price, which was a terrible idea. You know, that wasn't the normal price. 2 years before that, they were cheap, far cheaper. And it was all to do with energy prices, wasn't it? That was the fear. Everyone was panicking about petrol prices at the time, and electricity was still reasonable. So
I think there is... It is a new, it's customers will take time to get to understand what their value of that vehicle is. And so prices up and down. Mm. I think, when we first started the business, I was selling a Renault Zoe on a battery lease for $4,995. $5,000, right?
Mm.
Flying out the door. Because at $5,000, why wouldn't they?
Yeah.
I took one as a part exchange a couple of years ago, and I paid the guy $6,900, even though he bought it off me 2 years, 20,000 miles ago for $5,000.
So he was happy.
He sold it for $9,500, so it was a happy days. But the point being is there will be fluctuations in EVs, I think those fluctuations will, as it becomes more of the mainstream market, as more buyers are involved, those fluctuations, the highs and lows will flatten out, and it will follow more of a conventional market.
We will get to the podcast very shortly, the normal thing, but I have got a couple more questions because I find this a fascinating topic. And one of those is, you're right at the coalface of selling EVs. What is it now that consumers are worried about when it comes to the transition? What is the kind of what hurdles do you have to overcome when you have those discussions with people coming into your dealership?
Well, the first thing you have to do is walk the talk. So I every week get a customer comes in who says, I've tried to buy X or Z EV from a competitor, and I ask the salesman what they drive, and they say a diesel Qashqai, right? And so, and the customer's eyes just, they lose that sale. So the first thing you need to do is to be knowledgeable enough to actually have that conversation, because you have to be that person who is EV. First question always is, how can you charge at home? Have you got off-street parking? Because you know that's going to steer the next section of the conversation. Then you go to range. Now, I mean, we sell lots of cars to customers in London who don't have off-street parking. But you say, buy a Hyundai Kona. It's nice and small. It's real wheels around 240 miles. For most people in London, that's a week's worth of motoring. So you only got to charge it up once a week. Not a stress. Now, clearly, you don't sell them that 24 kilowatt Leaf that needs charging every day that does 70 miles on a charge. Because if you haven't got off-street parking, that's going to be a pain in the backside. So you've got to understand where they charge. And you've also got to understand that it's not always about charging at home. Workplace charging is coming. A lot of organizations are doing it. It's a relatively cheap thing to give to employees and makes them very happy, certainly the ones with EVs. It's also about saying, what else in your lifestyle? Where do you go to the gym? Has your gym got a charger? Do you go here? Do you get a football club? I mean, there's just lots of places where you will. So you've got to talk the charging conversation. You've then got to be honest about the fact that if you can charge at home, it's more economically beneficial than charging on public network. But that does depend on the individual. I mean, a lot of people will, you know, will do low miles, don't have off-street parking. There's still a huge benefit to it. And then the final thing you've obviously got to talk about is range. And, you know, the favorite line I always use is so you want a car with the batteries bigger than your bladder? You know, I mean, ultimately, if you're looking at a 50-year-old man who says, I can drive 400 miles without stopping, well, you just have to have a little conversation. You say, really?
Really? I mean, I'm every 25 miles, so I don't know about 400 miles.
but you know what I mean? Is if a car can do 200 miles, which is in London Southeast is 3 hours flipping motoring, you're going to stop. And then it's about saying, well, don't worry about range. Think about charging speed is just as important. Because if in that mystical 20 minutes you've plugged in, you've walked in, you've had your comfort break, you bought your overpriced coffee, you can add another 100 miles. That's 99% of the journeys for most people.
And my final question is, do you think the government needs to incentivize the used EV market? I mean, there is some talk of this at the moment, isn't there, from the likes of Auto Trader and others in the industry, thinking that there does need to be some perks and some incentivizing of customers to make that step. Do you think that's needed? And if so, what would that look like?
So I would say yes, please. Of course. I think a few things would help. I think clearly a cash incentive could work on a registration bonus. You know, basically but that will be difficult to happen. I suspect the what's happened in a lot of other countries is discounted finance that is supported, government-funded, basically low-cost finance, especially as the perception that they're expensive, if you can then got lower-cost finance. The other barrier to take up is clearly the lack of charge point grants. When we first started, you could get a charge point installed for £100. Now it's £1,200.
Yeah.
Well, £1,200 is a big barrier. What we tend to do is to put the cost of the charge point install as part of the car package so that it's part of the finance deal. It softens it. But even still, that's quite a barrier.
Martin, absolutely fascinating. Thank you for that insight into a very interesting world. But I think we probably should crack on, John. What do you think?
Yes, I'm sure that won't be the last we talk about EVs as we go through.
No, I'm sure.
If you haven't listened before, James and I have chosen our favourite stories from the car dealer website this week. We don't know what each other has chosen, and we're going to have a chat about each story as we go through. At the end, Martin gets to decide whose stories were the best and who is the winner. If you want to play along, you can tweet at Car Dealer Mag and let us know if you think we've missed any stories. I forgot to look up who won last week, but I can't be bothered. So, James, you can go first.
Thank you, John, for your enthusiasm. Right, I am going to start with news from Virtue's results that they have had to cut the number of Jaguar outlets. They will be running in the UK from 6 to just 1. So this was hidden in their annual results that came out day before yesterday. And Virtue said that they have booked a £1.5 million impairment charge relating to the terminated Jaguar operations in its latest accounts. So from November, Virtue says, the only dealership that will represent both Jaguar and Land Rover will be in Leeds. The remaining 5 sites will lose the Jaguar brand completely. And the reason I picked this story is it's a case of, I hate to say I told you so, but I told you so. And we ran this story back in April, I think it was, news that was leaked to Car Dealer off the back of a meeting that the manufacturer had with all of its franchise partners, where it said it was going to be cutting its network drastically from over 80 in the UK Jaguar dealers down to just 20 over the next 2 years. And this is proof that it's happening. I mean, Virtue Motors is the first person to report on this news, first dealership group to tell us this is happening. And it shows you that the follow-up story that we wrote about the fact that these dealers would have to take these impairment charges as a result of losing that franchise is actually very real and happening. The thing with this is, if you think back, and I look back at this when I wrote this story, Virtue, as recently as 2019, was still investing huge sums of money in these dual arts concepts. There was one in November 2020 that Virtue unveiled. They'd spent £3.6 million renovating this site in Nelson. They knocked the building down completely and rebuilt it as this dual arch showroom. And that was at a time when, well, I mean, not in, in very recent history off the back of that one, Jaguar was saying, wasn't it, that it was going to be this new volume brand. It was going to be selling lots of E-Paces and F-Paces and I-Paces. And then the market just fell out of Jaguar. So there's a lot of dealers out there that's invested huge sums of money, and now they're just being absolutely slashed. So this all hinges on what happens next. This house of brands strategy that JLR calls it, that is Range Rover, Defender, Discovery, and Jaguar, a smaller part. They're splitting their portfolio up into four different pillars. And I think they're expecting these huge showrooms to survive off the back of off those Land Rover sales. But the other thing waiting in the wings is agency. So we know that this brand is going to be moving towards agency sales. So there's probably a lot of dealers out there wondering how this is going to pan out. And the other thing it hinges on is, do they actually own that dealership? If they own the site, they can decide what they do with it. If they own the freehold of that site, they can decide, well, actually, Jaguar Land Rover, I don't think it's going to work for you. I'm going to make this into a used car centre, or I'm going to knock it down and make £15 million by building flats on top of it. But if they don't own that site, and it hinges on the fact that they are running that franchise, they're in very, very difficult positions. So I think this is the first we've seen of the impact that these cuts are going to have, but I do not think it's going to be the last.
I'm going to do that bit like they do on Watchdog now, where a quote appears on the screen. We reached out to JLR for comments, and they've issued a fresh statement to car dealer, which says, "We are making good progress delivering Reimagine, our strategy to realise a sustainability-driven vision of modern luxury. As part of the transformation, the retail network will be reconfigured, establishing new benchmark standards in customer service, quality, and efficiency for the luxury sector by right-sizing, repurposing, and reorganizing."
So I've got a few comments about that comment. Firstly, it came in to me 24 hours later after I reached out to them for comment. When they sent it across, I'm very glad that you put the emphasis on reconfigured, because that was underlined and bolded in the statement. Yes, it was in the statement that they sent across to me. And also, they've obviously had a lesson in alliteration there, haven't they? Reconfigured, right-sizing, repurposing, yes, and reorganizing. I mean, it sounds like Hans Face Space, doesn't it?
It does a bit. I was thinking the reconfiguring sounds like what you would describe your knocking down of your entire kitchen as, if you were being particularly delicate with your words. I'm reconfiguring this zone. Unfortunately, that means I've had to take the roof and the walls and the cabinets out and dig some new foundations, but it's being reconfigured.
Well, do you know what also interesting about that statement is, it was not a denial, was it?
No, that's right.
That wasn't a denial.
But this is the thing. Like, as we said originally, there was NDAs were signed, we understand, so that nobody could talk to us. Of course, they did anyway. The problem with an NDA blocking everything is that eventually people are going to notice that Jaguar signs are falling off the dealerships and no new Jaguars are arriving in them. So you can only keep it a secret for so long.
Yeah. Interesting one. Martin, what's your take on this saga?
Well, it's interesting. Back in the day, I worked for Ogilvy & Mather, the ad agency, on the Ford account. And actually, I worked on what was called the Premium Automotive Group. We had,
oh, yes, I remember it well.
Yeah, we had Volvo, we had Mazda, and we were trying to work out how to position all the different brands. And let's just say I can remember the PowerPoint now, where we were talking about Jaguar being a lower volume, upper market product. Yeah, I guess they didn't take that slide and use it.
Well, you never know. They might have done. They might have just resurfaced.
Yeah, this was in the 90s.
Well, there's funnily enough, one of the quotes. I think it was in another magazine, obviously very good, but in a different industry, so not a rival to us. But another magazine had a quote from one of the Jaguar people saying, "We want to bring it back to the Jaguar of 2006, And the someone had tweeted, well, hang on a minute, what was the Jaguar of 2006? You'd like an S type? Really? Want to go back to that? Is that what? Very strange.
So what was it described to me? It was described to me by a very senior industry exec, and I will not name them, but he said, the House of Brands, we all know, is a massive fudge, were his words. So it's interesting that these sort of people are just thinking, well, hang on a minute, it's not gonna work. And I'm going to be fascinated to see how this pans out. The JLR have threatened to talk to us a little bit further about this and put us in front of some senior people and explain how it's going to work. So I will believe that when I see it, but hopefully that's not too distant, not going to be in the not too distant future.
We'll be right back. You want the best return from your advertising budget, and CarGurus Piston Heads are focused on the same goal. With them, you have access to millions of monthly shoppers across both sites. Connect with in-market, high-quality buyers today and turbocharge your digital forecourt. For more information, visit dealerpackages.cargurus.co.uk and schedule a demo with their team. That's dealerpackages.cargurus.co.uk and tell them we sent you. Now, let's get back to the quiz.
Well, that's my first story, John. Over to you.
Okay, well, I'm going to keep it virtue and talk about a story we wrote this morning, Jack Williams wrote this morning. Robert Forrester has taken a fresh swipe at online disruptors. Kazoo. He didn't make Kazoo, I don't think. As Kazoo continues to struggle. So Robert Forrester had a couple of interviews today? There's certainly one.
There was one on Radio 4 and there was one on Sky News.
Yes. Well, in one of these interviews, he alluded again to the idea that purely online retailing is probably not as big as everyone thinks it's going to be, based on his numbers, which are something like 1 in 80 car sales for them are purely online. And they launched purely online in 2017, so they haven't been doing it for 10 minutes. Other things he talked about, aside from that, though, are EVs, which I thought was quite interesting.
Oh, I can see what you're doing here. Yeah. Please continue, John. Yeah. Play to your audience.
Well, Robert Forrester is quite behind the idea of EVs. As I understand. So, and I quote here, there's no reason why a fair proportion of the population can't drive an EV. He reckons that demand is cooling, but a recovery could be just around the corner. I think it's actually quite an interesting position, he said. As each car is launched, these electric vehicles are getting better. So they've either got better range or better technology, and there are phenomenal levels of technology in these cars. I think some people are just reticent of what time is the right time to buy.
Do you know what I thought was interesting? I read that story too this morning, and it was quite interesting that he hasn't had an electric car up until this point, and he's only just ordered one, hasn't he? So he thinks that now, he said he now thinks that the ranges are enough for, he obviously travels a lot around the country visiting lots of dealers, who you would hope would all have a charging points in them by this point. And he's now ordered an electric car to do that. I wonder which one it is.
I was thinking that. Yeah. Well, he's in the interview with Sky, he's standing in front of a Honda E, so I'm hoping it's that.
Probably not, because that means he would only be able to get to the bottom of his drive.
And back,
yeah. To plug in again.
But it is in the very popular Charge Yellow.
Yes, that is a very good colour.
I must say, I do love the Honda E. It's just such a shame that it was too expensive, and
well, it's got more expensive since it was launched. Yeah, I mean, I think it was about 32 grand when we first drove it, and now it's about 36 or something for the advance. I think they've binned off the lower model, but
I think it's such a shame, that car. I honestly think that could have been a huge, huge hit for Honda if they'd just priced it or priced it a bit more sensibly. I don't know, what Martin, what did you think about the Honda?
I've got four of them in stock, and I think they're really actually very good.
Yeah,
what. They make you smile when you drive those. It's the complete opposite of driving an Audi TT, though. People let you out of a junction. It's the car that more people will let you out in than anything else. People look at it and they just don't really know it, like it, smile about it. Yeah, and we do sell them to a really wide range of people. You get the obvious, the London urbanites in their 20s. That's their sort of thing. But you get mature consumers driving them as well.
I've seen a mature consumer driving one. Somebody who should perhaps be in a jazz, as you know, cliche would suggest.
I have.
Are you talking about my
fear of taking in a jazz against one of those, I can assure you.
There you go. No, they are fantastic. Well, yeah, so and they drive really well as well, don't they? I mean, they've got, like, not to get really nerdy, but Honda put a lot of expensive chassis bits into those. They're independent suspension all the way around, I think.
What sort of money are they now used, Martin?
£25,000.
Mm. Bit slightly more sensible.
Yeah, I mean, the audience for them are also people just love them. And so quite often you'll get someone who comes in and is unsure and then just goes, wow, what is that? And then, you know, as long as you're reasonable and say it will only do 100 miles. But if it's a second car, that's probably, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm.
They're great.
I think it'll age very gracefully as well.
Yes.
Anyway, James, do you want to move us on?
I think I will. Okay, my next story is another one of these scams. So these scam car dealers that we've been investigating back to October, I think the first one was. This time, far more sophisticated. So this is an online car auction called Elveron Limited, which is a new one that's popped up in the last couple of weeks. We've had a lot of emails from consumers who fear that they've either been caught out by this or were about to be caught out by it and were worried that this was a fake. And it actually took us some digging. So this is a story that Rebecca wrote. She had to do quite a bit of digging to actually find this one because all our usual checks weren't quite there. And that actually on first look, when I looked at it on my mobile just while I was out when the first email came in, it did look pretty genuine. So it was only because Rebecca contacted the company, Elveron Limited, which is a legitimate business, which has been cloned. She contacted their accountants because they'd only just filed their accounts with Companies House and said, do you know anything about this website? Is it anything to do with you? And the director came back to Rebecca near enough immediately and said, no, this is a scam. How can we stop it? This time, so if you remember back, some of these other online car dealers just basically pretend to be a car dealer with a website, price their cars really cheaply, advertise them on Facebook to consumers, and those people get caught out by sending them a deposit. Obviously, the car never exists. They lose their money. But this time, they're doing it with an auction website. They've stolen detail from Cazoo's website. So the 300-point check that Cazoo has, they've basically copied and used it on their website. They've stolen images from websites like Driving Electric. And the car adverts have a, quite cleverly in this instant, have a buy it now price and a bid price. So people have to pay to be a member to this site. So if they want to bid for the cheaper price, they have to pay a £2,000 fee to join it. So firstly, that's one way that they're stealing the customers' money. And then if they do actually buy a car, if they do it at the buy it now price, they'd obviously steal the money that way. But if they do actually buy a car, they're gonna ask for the deposit and it will be stolen again. So we've actually seen some of the documents, haven't we, that they've sent out. Some of the consumers have sent us the DocuSign information that they send out, the links. They look incredibly legitimate. And actually, if you do a little bit of due diligence as a customer, check them out on Companies House. They exist as a company. Look at the website. It looks very professionally done. It's got, says we've sold 16,000 cars or 19,000 cars, 16,000 satisfied customers. Don't quite tally up those numbers, do they? But they say they've, and one of the quotes was, we've had absolutely no issues so far. I mean, if that isn't a red flag. I don't know what is, but it's only if you really sort of know what you're looking for and suspect it's a con do you actually start looking at it in a little bit more detail. But I think the worrying thing with this for me, John, is the fact that it is a completely different scam, isn't it?
It's
not a car dealer one. This is an auction site set up in the same way, and actually I'm sure you've looked at the website. It looks far more professional, doesn't it?
Yeah, I was in the same boat as you when we get hundreds of emails every month from people saying, is this a scam? And 99% of the time, yes, it is. But this came through and it didn't look like a scam necessarily to me. It just looked kind of fine because all the ones that we've covered so far, as you say, have been very sort of, they look like half an hour job of sorting out a website. They just throw something up. It's got some nonsense on it. It's stupid things like sometimes it doesn't, the pound sign is after the amount of money.
Yes.
And, you know, yeah, strange little things like that where you just think this is clearly a weird template they've used. It doesn't fit the same pattern. It's a completely different model. It's an actual functioning website where you can create an account and log in. It's all very different. And, yeah, it's things like, as you were saying, they've stolen SEO copy, as I would call it, from places like Kazoo and various electric car websites, all these sorts of things. So they're obviously expecting to get some traction on Google. As far as I'm aware, this isn't actually on Google. When you Google this website, it doesn't come up.
No, and when they say that they've been in existence for so long, that should be a warning sign. I had a very interesting phone call this morning from Simon Hunt, who runs Brago, which is a very similar car data platform, like a bit like Kazana was. So they do pricing, especially in the luxury car market. But he said he's been following these stories since we started writing them in October, and he said this latest one annoyed him so much. He wants to try and do something about it. And what he did is, because they get a lot of their information by looking at all the dealer websites and all the feeds, he could see from his systems that this website had used a lot of other dealers' images, but they weren't ones that are existing on online now. They were from a couple of months back that have since been deleted, but he could see that they had the same metadata and they'd effectively been stolen. So he said to me that he's going to try and build some form of system on his site that we're going to work together on with Car Dealer that will help consumers put these details in and check them, help them know whether that some of these red flags, like the fact that the website was domain name was only registered a couple of months ago or a month ago. I mean,
by saying they've been in business for 15 years. Or
yeah.
Something.
So there are some things that hopefully can help them, because I'm as frustrated as everybody else in the industry about this, because it's giving car dealers a very bad name. And actually we need to be doing all we can to highlight the fact that these scammers are out there, and that all the more reason to go to a genuine dealer that has got a site, and you can meet the people, and you can, you know, meet people like Martin and shake their hand and know that they, where you can go back. Martin, do they frustrate you as much as they frustrate me?
Oh, absolutely. It's just not as much as the frustration I had with my teenage son, who's borrowed the credit card to order a pair of Nike Airs from a site called jordansales.com. Yeah. Oh. Did those 150 quid arrive? Did they, heck?
Oh, dear.
But yeah, the point is, it's happening in lots of different markets.
Yeah.
And I think it is it's something which both the payment providers have got to really understand here, because in that scenario, my first port of call was an old employee of mine who was Barclaycard, and I was immediately got the refund pushed through Barclaycard, because ultimately they can get the money out of the person who took it out of the credit card. And I think with these scenarios, it's got to be something where it's the banks that are going to have to really justify that they've transferred the money to an account that has been opened 2 days ago, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that, you know, and if it's pound on pound UK currency, then the banks are going to have to work really hard to persuade the other bank that it's a fair transfer and that it was legitimate. So I think it's about payment and managing it.
Yeah.
But absolutely, yeah, it's frustrating as anything.
And it's like whack-a-mole. As soon as we report on one, the next one just pops up. And actually, as we're seeing now, they're getting more sophisticated, because they're probably making so much money out of this as a result. I think we have one of the stories where the guy teased the person he'd stolen the money from, saying, well, he's saying, how do people fall for this? How do you get away with it? Well, he said, I made hundreds of thousands of pounds on this. So you can see that for every one person who suspects it's a scam, there's probably 10 who don't realise and lose their money.
And I suspect they are very multinational. So if you can run it here, you can run it in any European country, you can run it in, you know, and you only need to run it in 10 countries. Yeah.
I think this is a much wider problem, but one that we will keep reporting on, because every time we report on it, like John points out, we put a story out there. It goes. We Google very well as a result. People Google the name, and I'm sure if you did it now, you'd be able to find them. The story will come up very high up, and it says they're a scam and helps warn them. But that's my story, John. Back to you.
Very good. Sorry, I was just frantically muting myself there because an ice cream van had driven by, but I think we're safe.
99 with a flake, please.
Oh, if you're paying. I'm going to move on to the royal family, or more specifically, King Charles. So this is a story about a very nice looking Bentley, which has popped up for sale a dealer in Sheffield, John Holland Sales. And quite astutely, I think, they've realised that this particular Bentley that's arrived has been, used by the king, is the phrase I will use. There's photographic evidence of him sort of emerging from it. So that's quite the reason I bring this up, obviously, partially because we've just coronated him, if that's the verb to use. And partially because I think it's always wise when you're, well, I do this when I'm shopping around for cars anyway, but like give a quick Google of the number plate, because sometimes things pop up where there's been sometimes not so good things happen, but sometimes a nice celebrity owner might come to light. And I think the royal family are a prime example of this, because I'm assuming he didn't actually own this Bentley. It's on in the photo that's provided, it's on a Bentley UK number plate. And I think a lot of celebrities and royal household members get lent cars for a little while, don't they? So there's a very good chance that if you're buying a Bentley or a Range Rover, or a reasonable chance if you're buying an Audi, because they love their Audis, that at some point a member of the royal household has touched it, and therefore it might be worth more money.
You've said that, and while you've been saying that, I have just Googled the number plate of my Audi RS6 long-termer, and there is a picture from Evo magazine of it about a foot off the floor flying through the air.
Yes.
So if there is proof that you should do it, that is it.
Yeah, and I mean, for some new owners, that will be a positive that it's been in Evo flying over a speed bump, but for others, not so much.
About a year ago, a guy phoned me up and said, I've got the best launch edition Nissan Leaf in the country. You're going to want to buy it. And he wanted ridiculous money for it because it was the car that Jeremy Clarkson tried to use the 3-pin plug. And he was trying to convince me that, you know, that was going to make this particular one, that famous episode of Top Gear. And he was convinced that this car was worth, yeah.
The famous episode that ridiculed the poor Nissan Leaf. Because correct. They drove it around and didn't plug it in. Yeah.
Yeah. That was, let's just say that didn't go into stock.
Martin, while we're on the subject of deals like that, I'm going to ask you a very quick question. What is your most memorable car sale? I always like to ask this question of car dealers.
What's the most memorable one?
Can't remember it.
No. I think it's got to be the first one, because literally set this business up having worked in advertising agencies, having worked as a marketer, but never actually having sold a car in my life. And you know, literally set it up and it was, you know, off a driveway. We literally had five cars and someone came in and bought a Nissan Leaf. And I remember just going back inside and saying, I've actually done it. I've actually sold a flipping car. What do I do now?
Buy another one.
Buy another one. Yeah, exactly. But it was that moment of learning, of just getting going, okay, this is a business that's there is someone out there that will buy a used electric car.
Has the industry sort of got in your blood now? I mean, is it sort of thing, is this it for life now? Do you absolutely love it?
I wouldn't say I love it.
Because we'd ask you in September.
Yeah, if you'd have said 31st of August, I would have said it's brilliant. I think the key thing I'm enjoying is just the speed of change. And you know, quite literally, talk about keeping you on your toes. This marketplace is very much about that. Of course, the fellow traders that are characters that buy all my trade-ins and phone me up and tell me they've got this one owner Nissan Leaf that's, you know, wonderful condition, et cetera, et cetera. That's always lovely to meet other drivers and other car professionals.
It's certainly full of characters, isn't it, this industry? Right, I am going to go my last story, John, which is I was going to go with our most popular one of the week, but I've decided not to because I won't be able to talk about it for very long because it was very short. But this is a story about car dealership group John Grouse. Grouse? Gross?
Good question.
Gross. I'm going to say Grouse. John Grouse. And it's their results for 2022, and they clocked up profits of £8.3 million. But this is despite, they say, frustrations caused by car maker Stellantis. So John Grouse Group is based in Suffolk. They've got Ford, Kia, Peugeot, Citroën and DS dealers. And they actually had record year last year for the year ending December the 31st. Revenue was up to 188 million, up 18% on the year before. As they say, demand recovered to pre-pandemic levels. But their profit was up 32%. On the £6.3 million they made the year before. They were 68th in the car dealer top 100 list of most profitable dealers last year, so it'd be interesting to see where they come this year. But it was that comment about Stellantis that I thought was very, very interesting. Their chairman and managing director, Ian Twinley, was the guy who wrote the update in the accounts. And he said Stellantis' merger of IT platforms and the rationalization of supply chains was a major source of frustration to the franchised networks. He said this is likely why the Stellantis brands did not fare well in the 2022 UK dealer attitude surveys, along with market share pressures and poor dealer profitability. So I just thought it was interesting that those comments and the fact that it was obviously serious enough for him to have to point it out in their annual report. We know Stellantis dealers have had some difficult times. We reported at the back end of last year about all those cars that they were having to register imports, weren't we, that weren't being delivered to customers, and they were having to ring customers up and ask them to pay their first finance payments and still not to be able to tell them when the cars would arrive. I hear that hasn't actually got that much better. But the interesting, this comment broke out in this annual report. So clearly some people frustrated, and Ian there from John Grouse Group, quite happy to publicly state it in the documents uploaded to Companies House. But that set aside, a very impressive set of results for a family-owned dealer group. £8.3 million profit last year. After the year that was said to be the Carlsberg year for the motor trade, Eddie Hawthorne said, of 2021, it's nice to see some dealer groups are continuing that amazing performance.
Just going back to the Stellantis bit. Sorry, Stellantis. I don't envy Stellantis or the people at Stellantis and their dealers trying to deal with the amalgamation of all these different things. Because if you think about the plethora of different brands that Stellantis have got under its wings, there must be so many legacy systems to try and integrate. And I mean, what have you got? So you had Fiat that was separate once upon a time. You had, Jeep is a separate thing, of course. You've got Peugeot and Citroën were one. Vauxhall was a separate thing. There's all these other little, the Maserati and things like that count. I mean, there's a lot of different brands in there, it's like almost about five companies have merged into one in a way, in terms of, well, of course, five companies have merged into one. There's about seven different brands, but there's got to be a lot of legacy stuff floating around that they're going to have to work through. I would have thought they'd have done it by now because it's been.
Yeah, but since I know. I agree with you. No wonder it was painful.
Yeah.
And we felt it with parts supply on a few of those brands. We do a lot of Peugeot. We've dabbled with DS and yeah, the moment of saying, well, there was a speedo issue with the 3D display speedos on some of the Peugeots, you know, and you're sitting there saying, sorry, did you really say 24-week delay on that part? Ooh. I know. And you're sitting there thinking, well, that car's on stock in finance. What do I do?
Yeah, that's painful.
That But yeah, it's absolutely, it must have been an IT. But I think also culturally, you know, you've got all those different brands that are run sort of differently. And I think also on a retail environment, you know, the customer experience stuff across all of those brands is going to again be different. I think that's going to be a bit of a challenge. And I think if they are to merge some of the servicing, multi-brand service centers as well, how's that going to work? You know, is a Vauxhall customer really going to nudge into a DS customer? You know, I mean, it's a different demographic that are buying each of those brands, and not necessarily sure it's all the same.
I'm going to go slightly off topic now. I know we're coming to the end of our podcast, but I'm going to ask anyway. Speaking of issues with things like speedos and so on, just something I've had in my head talking about Nissan Leafs. How do you find the difficulty of evaluating the stock that you're buying? Because it's very different when a battery is worth so much of that car. And if you bought the wrong Nissan Leaf, for example, with 5 battery bars instead of 12, battery bars, for the uninitiated who are listening, are a little bar thing that tells you how much health supposedly your Nissan Leaf's battery has got in it. And I assume this is the case for many EVs as well, but it's probably a bit harder to see. How do you go about evaluating that?
And the answer is there's lots of systems we've had to put in place. Understand that. Certain, you know, auction houses are not helping themselves on that. There's certainly a lot that could be done there. For example, we've worked quite hard with Motorway to convince them that they cannot list a Nissan Leaf without a picture of the speedo with the battery bar. Where normally the wheel is turned because the photo says you've got to show the tires. So the steering wheel was always over the bit that showed the battery health. So, you know, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's stuff that you want to know. But I guess in many ways, the way I always say back to people is also, if you're buying a diesel car and the previous owner used to rev it when it was cold, you'd never know.
Yeah.
It's got a hidden problem, but you would never know until that problem suddenly went bang. And so I think the opportunity with batteries is actually they've got all that information in them, and it's a case of getting them out and understanding how you can read that. And we've got some in-house stuff that does that, and we've got systems that we do, because, well, the brand EV expert says we should at least be able to do that.
Absolutely. Have you had to do any kind of repairs or anything with batteries?
In all the cars we've sold, we have had to refurbish one battery.
Not bad. Not bad.
The thing is, all the batteries are pretty similar technology that's in them, and they all degrade by 1% to 2%. It's pretty even across all of them. The Nissan Leaf with the air-cooled battery is a bit more susceptible to lots of rapid charging. But if you do that research, yes, it's susceptible. If you're in Nevada and it's 40 degrees outside, and you turn up at a rapid charger and you put in a load of volts, then you're going to bugger the battery. But you're not going to have that problem in Blighty so often.
No.
So no, it's just reassurance that the problems are just not out there.
That's very good to hear.
I would add, though, is the service history is really important. Because the bigger problem you get is the battery management software. If the battery management software hasn't been updated correctly, the battery can tell you the range meter can be all over the place. It can actually show that the battery's not working when in fact it is. I will show the analogy. If you left your phone or your laptop for 5 years and then pressed do all updates, it's not going well, right? But then you're taking a car that's never been serviced for 5 years and trying to apply all of those battery management software updates at the same time, ain't going to end well. Blue screen of death.
That's interesting, because the perception with an EV is, well, what do they actually do when they service it? Well, you know, they replace the pollen filter, look under the bonnet and go, oh yeah, it's all still there. Tires are all right. Great, off you go. But yeah, there are software.
The BMS is really, really good. And actually, it's that battery management software that is evolving quite quickly. And so, Jaguar I-Pace is a great example. You know, within a few months of it coming out, it suddenly had 15 miles more range. And that was an over-the-air update. But again, if you've not done that updates, and it was simply because once they'd launched it, they felt a bit more confident to increase the capacity of the or the usable capacity of the battery. I mean, rocket science. But again, if that update hadn't been applied, you'd look at the battery on the iPad and think, oh, it's only showing that. Well, actually, you just do the update and it would suddenly improve again. So no, they are computers on wheels, and treat them like that.
Some useful EV buying advice there. Oh, James, go on.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say I'm out of stories, but I do want to mention, because I've mentioned it twice in this podcast, what the most popular story of the week was. And the headline was, the car dealership ordered to pay more than £1,000 after they would not disclose who was driving a vehicle. Rebecca wrote that story on Saturday, and it's now our most popular story of the year with 178,000 views so far this week. Beating the next place story by about 300 views. So very
popular. Is that every dealer in the country looking up, could I get away with not paying?
I think it probably is. But if you're interested in that story, go and read it on our website. Mm. Well, that's me out, John. You've nicked some of mine. I have no more.
Well, I had one more, but I'm going to leave it because we have run out of time. So, Martin, before we ask for your verdict, are there any stories you think we've missed?
Well, you've nicked the three that I was going to go with, which was the Bentley, the Jaguar, and the cloned company websites. So no is the answer.
Excellent news. So who do you think is the winner?
I think, despite you having lots of EV stories, I'm afraid it's James's Jaguar story.
Thank you, Martin. That is good news to hear. A win in the bag, John. Once again.
Yeah. After my winning streak.
Martin, thank you very much for taking all of our questions as well. I found it absolutely fascinating hearing about your business. I wish you all the best for the rest of the year.
Thanks a lot. Really nice to chat, guys.
Yes, it's been great to have you on, Martin. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you as well to James for coming on and talking about his extension. And thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode. So make sure you're subscribed so you can be notified when that goes live. If you're listening on Spotify, don't forget you can swipe up now and vote on who you think won. If you want to check out the stories we've mentioned today, you can click the links in the show notes below or head to cardealermagazine.co.uk, where you'll find lots more news besides that. Thanks again, and until next time, goodbye.